Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And I'm going to try not to get too excited because when I start speaking dynamically, or I should say passionately, my dynamics make it really hard to get these shows ready, because yours truly has to do the editing. As a matter of fact, I joke around a lot, like telling people I've got to fire my IT guy, because that's me. Anyway, we're covering Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. There's a lot to get through, and I'm going to miss Paul. Paul's not here today. And I say that because he's such a good reader. He's really focused and is capable of reading really well. I don't want to say I suffer from attention deficit disorder. I don't. My problem is I can't not think about other things. What I mean by that is, as I'm reading, I'm constantly thinking about, you know, what's going on here? What am I doing there? I mean, I think most people might have this problem. Very few people, I think, suffer from it, because I don't know a lot of people that get caught into multiple conversations at the same time. And that used to really annoy my wife when we would go to parties, and I would actually kind of keep track of a few different conversations and kind of pipe in, and you know, she says, choose one, just choose one little group you want to focus on. Anyway, for what it's worth, what we're trying to do is we're trying to help dispel this concept that the framers were prejudiced, that the Constitution was written by a bunch of racists. And because I know it's not there. As a matter of fact, I know that these men, many of these men, were seeking to not aggrandize the southern states who wanted to maintain slavery. As a matter of fact, they kept on making arguments, as we kind of showed yesterday, that, you know, because they had more people and their people were property, and their property was worth more, they needed more representation. And as a matter of fact, we kind of ended on the going off, or I should say going back and forth between the Carolinas. We actually had the two Carolinas basically make the assertion that they be allowed an additional representative. And so it got shot down each time. And the only state that was not necessarily one of those three states, Georgia, Carolina, and South Carolina, North Carolina, was the second one, which was with the second motion, because the first motion was to allow North Carolina an extra representative because they felt that their property was worth more. And they actually talked about that because that was actually kind of coming up in context to the Western states. You have to understand that there were less people in the South that were white that would be willing or capable of going and fighting a war. In other words, let's think about this. And I don't think anybody had said this, but when you look at the slave states, how many people could be actually recruited to go fight a war for the militia to go somewhere out of the state? Not very many, because they can't afford to, you know, let too many people leave, because they need people there to keep the slaves as slaves. You get rid of too many folks on the plantation, and next thing you know, you have a real problem. So it was actually in the northern states' advantage. And as a matter of fact, growing the states and everything else. So the question is, how is it that they were constantly capable of getting slavery passed, or I should say the advancements of growing slavery and keeping it instead of actually getting rid of it? When we get to August 22nd, when George Mason basically just hits the roof. And as a matter of fact, Madison at a certain point in time gets really upset about the 1808 clause, because nobody's going to remember that that clause is in there. They actually wanted to get rid of slavery. The Virginians, the majority of the Virginians, the delegations, because that's what they had to do. They voted by delegation. And so, folks, if you're watching this, if you're looking at this constitutional convention, then you realize that the process is each body of government gets one vote. So when you go to if you go into a state constitutional convention and your county has, actually, if you look at your county not being the most populated county, it doesn't matter. It gets one vote. It should have one vote. The reason that the large counties today have a greater representation and they have greater power is because we've allowed democracy. Now, if these big counties wanted to actually be smart and gain representation, they would have to split themselves up. This is why I've been saying LA, Seattle, these major metropolises really do need to be subdivided instead of being one big county. Because one big county, you got one vote in the state constitutional convention. That's it. Just like Virginia was one, because we had to recognize that each of these were parties to the compact. When you look at your county, the counties being the parties to the compact, they all have to be on equal footing. It doesn't matter because somebody's on the coast. Every part of that county is integral to the county, or those counties need to really discuss whether there's a necessity for being in the same state together. Because, and this is why I tell people that are pursuing this path of, splitting your state, like Washington State. I tell people, drive yourself into a state constitutional convention. Scare the crap out of the progressives to say, because all the evidence is on your side. The counties all had one vote, as well as in the constitutional convention. And in the real proper, underneath the protection of the U.S. Constitution, you should demand that equal footing, that equal representation. And if they don't, then this is where we actually have to start putting more pressure. And so, because you're going to find that even though Los Angeles County, Orange County, Riverside County, they come off so these really super big cities, they're going to be very corrupt because they've allowed so many illegals and so many people are beholden to them. That, the good people have either left or they're just suffering because they just don't have any hope. Let me also say this. As we look at what's going on the East Coast, and as I talk about these things, I understand that the East Coast, anybody that's living on the Atlantic coastline, even Florida, not down into the south. When we look at how America is going to be saved, it is going to be saved by the heartland, because that is where you have your mass of constitutionalists, or I should say states that are capable of actually stepping up and defending the Constitution and demanding full compliance, because it's all about demanding full compliance. So we're getting into these debates, and again, it just boggles my brain how they didn't contain slavery. In other words, how they finally got to that point on August 21st or what have you, because in August 22nd was where the concession was made outside of the voting. Because when we go there, I believe Mason is the first person that kicks that day off, basically screaming and clamoring. So the The compromise probably happened on the 21st, or maybe before that, and Mason finally got a chance to get, you know, a word in edgewise. Bottom line, some of the things that they were exposing here is very, very important. Now, I understand also that those who are on the Atlantic coastline, or actually east of the Mississippi, don't understand what it is like not having control of your property. In other words, when you look at these states that have all sorts of federal ownership, you know, it's happening to us. There, you know, it becomes this obvious question, why is it that we're not sharing this burden with the East Coast? Actually, what we want to do is we want to get out of these unconstitutional grasps that the federal government has. So bottom line, when we look at where the incentive is for standing up against it, we need the Atlantic Coast's help to actually say, hey, you can't do that. Just because they perverted and redefined the Constitution as they went along doesn't make it legitimate. You have no authority to do that, because eventually what's going to end up happening is they're going to do the same thing to you. You don't think so, folks? I encourage you to go look at the CO2 pipeline plan, because there is not one state in the union, the two states that have the least footprint of a CO2 pipeline is Wyoming and Utah. You know, those are kind of, they have a little, you know, cropping coming in their borders, but it doesn't like traverse the entire state. Go look at how you're going to be affected, because what's going on in Iowa, South Dakota, and those central north states, that's coming to you. Those people that are fighting that tyranny need your help. This is why we make this huge mistake of not understanding that we're all suffering in the union, and we all need to unite. We all need to actually start standing up. Now, you say, well, I can't necessarily sign a petition or be involved in what's going on in these other states, because I'm not a resident of that. When it comes to the U.S. Constitution, every U.S. citizen has a right to petition government for the redress of grievances against the U.S. Constitution. Now, it's one thing if it's a U.S., or I should say, a South Dakota constitutional violation. In other words, if South Dakota is violating their own constitution, then you in Georgia, you in Virginia, you really don't have a dog in that fight, because you're not a citizen. It doesn't affect you. But any violation, regardless of where it is occurring, then you do have a right to actually petition. As a matter of fact, we would encourage you, and what we want to do is, again, I'm making this plea. Get organized. Start at least. I mean, seems like every month we get a few new people coming in, whether they're, you know, a group, a body, an entity, or an individual. But it seems like we are getting people. I want you to think about this. If you actually went out and started getting people to sign petitions to stop geoengineering, we have now a 9-petition amalgamation that actually calls out very specific things. If you actually took all 9 of these petitions, you wouldn't need to have them sign each petition. You'd only need to have your citizens, U.S. citizens in your state and county, sign these 9 petitions. Now, once you've signed these things, then you can actually share your signatures, and we can create this national repository of signatures with, and down the road, we may have you do affidavits. Everybody that has one will just need to do an affidavit that you verify that the people's, you know, the people's signatures that you collected were U.S. citizens. They don't have to be registered voters. They only need to be 17 years of age and U.S. citizens. Why? Because a 17-year-old is eligible to actually leave their home and actually go and enlist in the militia and or the armed forces and actually participate in war. So at that point, you don't even have to be a voter or be a registered voter. You just need to be a 17-year-old because they do allow 17-year-olds to go serve. So I want you to start thinking about this, because if you can contribute 500 signatures that are going into county commissioners, along with what they've collected is a couple hundred here, a couple hundred there, and another state collects another 1,000, and another state collects. I mean, you can easily come to a point where we're waking up America and sharing and resonating the voices of the U.S. citizens so that everybody starts understanding how important it is to start stopping what is actually starting in some of these states, such as Iowa. We want you to know that your contributions, whether it be time and, you know, going out collecting signatures or what have you, is necessary. Let me ask you this. Would you rather pick up a gun and actually fight foreign warriors on our soil, or would you rather get our government into compliance? Because there's many different things that are going to end up happening. One thing that could happen that you have the ability to change is allowing our Constitution to fail and our federal government to default, where they claim that they go into default and they surrender. The only hope at that point are your states. If your states have not stood up against that federal government when it does that, it's over. That's it. Doesn't matter if you're a U.S. citizen or if you're a sovereign citizen. It don't matter, because it's all done. Now, I will tell you that those people who are sovereign citizens are probably going to be the first ones rounded up and taken care of. I mean, just remember how this all transpires when nations fall and they fall into evil. Those people who are identified as threats, go look at what happened with Pol Pot. Go look at what happened with Mao, Stalin. Go look at what happened after all of these revolutions. When it came time to die, they made choices of those who were the threats, they go first. And those who, you know, could actually come back and bite you in the butt, like those who were assisting in the ranks of the Bolshevik Revolution that, you know, could actually, you know, become a threat, they end up going too. Let's be clear here. They have too many people in their paradigm. They only need a half a billion to survive. That's what they believe. That's all they need to live their comfy life moving forward. And actually, it seems like they're trying to create this utopia of Logan's Run, where, you know, society only lives for so long, or at least certain people in society will only live for so long. And I'm going, folks, let's dive into the notes. I've probably spent way too much time just diving into these details. So let's go into the next motion, which is basically for Georgia. Now, General Pinckney and Mr. Houston this time instead of Mr. Butler, because the first one was Pinckney for South Carolina and Mr. Martin from North Carolina. And then Pinckney and Butler from South Carolina. And now Mr. Houston and Pinckney. And I think Mr. Houston's probably from Georgia. Is he not? Let me see here. No. Yeah, he is. William Houston. So there was in each of the cases, Pinckney from South Carolina, and then there was a representative from the other delegations of North Carolina, South Carolina, and now Georgia. So now Mr. Pinckney and Mr. Houston moved, and you had to coordinate this. Why? Because when you make a motion, somebody has to second it. And so it was basically moved with Georgia to be allowed four representatives instead of three, urging the unexampled celerity of its population on the question it passed in the negative. And again, the only three states that voted for it were the Carolinas and Georgia. Mr. Madison moved that the number allowed to each state be doubled. A majority of a quorum of 65 was too small a number to be represent the whole inhabitants of the United States. Now, listen, he's actually looking at increasing the members of representations in Congress. And I believe they were using this fixed number of 40,000. That would have taken it to 20,000. So anyway, they would not possess enough of the confidence of the people and would be too sparsely taken from the people to bring them all the local information which would be frequently wanted. Double the number will not be too great, even if the future additions from new states, the additional expense was too inconsiderable to regard it as an important case. And as far as the augmentation might be unpopular on that score, the objection was overbalanced by its effects on the hopes of a greater number of the popular candidates. Now, I know that they were actually going to be talking about the distance and the burden that this was going to create. Folks, you have no idea. Trying to take up a household hundreds of miles away where you're days away. You know, there's not Dulles in D.C. at this point where you fly in and out. It took time. They didn't have the resources. I mean, you know, when you took the man out of the house in those days, I mean, it was a team. And each of the, you know, parents, the mother and the father, the adults of the property, you know, they were all integral. It was a hardship removing somebody. Now, in the South, they had plantations and slaves, and they wanted to increase their representation. In the North, it was a little bit harder because they didn't have slaves. It was really, the burden was really placed upon the members of the family. And, oh, by the way, the reason they had large families back in those days was for labor purposes. They needed the help to be able to plant the food that they needed. And this is how, you know, generations survived. Anyway, so Mr. Ellsworth, Sherman, Gary, Mason, and so forth, they all kind of, you know, make comments about this. There's a lot of other things. But what I want to do is I want to jump down to the next day, July 11th. And they start diving into the concept of property again. And so South Carolina, Mr. Butler, basically said this. He insisted that the labor of a slave in South Carolina was as productive and valuable as that of a freeman in Massachusetts, that as wealth was the great means of defense and utility, the nation, they were equally valuable to it with freemen. Now, like I just said, this flies in the face of reason. When you really think about, you know, the slaves and basically having compulsion and enslavement, no human being wants to be a slave. No human being wants to be told what they have to eat and what they're going to get. You have no choices. And anybody in that circumstance would gladly get out from underneath that. Unless you're actually being doted over and taken care of. I mean, if you understand how there's two ways of enslaving people, by, you know, indulging them and or by force. Now, there were slave masters that were indulging slave masters because in those days, and I'll tell you, George Washington was one of those guys. He doted over his slaves. I mean, when one was sick, he was out there with them, taking care of them. And it wasn't just about losing a slave. I mean, he cared for them almost as if they were his family. As a matter of fact, if you read any of the biographies on this, you'll actually find that Washington was a very compassionate man when it came to his slaves. When one would run away, he would actually go and plead and say, look, You know, if you get captured, you're going to be a slave for somebody else, and they're not going to treat you the same. You know, he tried, but he never used force. And as a matter of fact, he was more forceful with his troops than with his slaves. I'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so anyway, as we're kind of covering this, he goes on and says, and that consequently, an equal representation ought to be allowed for them in a government which is instituted principally for the protection of property and was itself to be supported by property. Now, this actually flies in the face of what Madison basically talks about regarding the principles or the primary objects of government. The first and foremost object of government is to protect life. The second is to protect private property. And so, and I'm just, you know, kind of paraphrasing Madison. I think it's Federalist 10. And he stated this about property in his essay on property. And so he basically starts spelling out some of the things that he did, Thomas Jefferson did, and the way they were articulating clearly created the paradigm that life was precious, that we needed to protect both life and liberty. So liberty was the ancillary thing after those, right? When we look at life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, that was a part of the Declaration. So Mr. Mason stands up and basically says he could not agree to the motion, not with Madison, but this other motion that was being put out. This was being put out. So Mr. Mason said he could not agree to the motion, notwithstanding it was favorable to Virginia, but he thought it unjust. It was certain that slaves were valuable as they raised the value of land, increased the exports and imports, and of course the revenue would supply the means of feeding and supporting an army, and might in cases emergency become themselves soldiers. Yeah, right. Only if you guaranteed their freedom. That was a big contribution to the Revolutionary War. As in these important respects, because actually go back to the Revolutionary War. I don't want to misrepresent anything. The blacks, the freedmen that were freed from slavery that fought in the war, not that they didn't fight ferociously, the majority of the fighting was actually being done by the North. Massachusetts was the first militia to get involved, and many of those states up in the North were very, very ardent in supporting, and the requisitions for troops started coming out of Virginia and some of the other states, but when they started adding blacks, it wasn't like they became a, you know, half of the army type of thing. Anyway, as in these important respects, they were useful to the community at large, they ought not to be excluded from the estimate of representation. He could not, however, regard them to equal to freemen, and he could not vote for them as such. He added as worthy of a remark that the southern states have this peculiar species of property over and above the other species of property common to the states. Mr. Williamson of North Carolina said, reminded Mr. Gorham left that if the Southern states contended for the inferiority of blacks to whites when taxation was in view, the Eastern states on the same occasion contended for their equality. He did not, however, either then or now concur in either extreme, but approved of the ratio of the 3/5. On Mr. Butler's motion for considering blacks as equal to whites in the apportionment of representation, this is how they voted. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New York was not on the floor, so they couldn't vote, but because of Hamilton, I believe, at this point, had left, and Livingston and Lang, I guess, the other two, were already gone. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware happened to again vote yes in favor of slavery. Maryland, no. Virginia, no. And even North Carolina, no. South Carolina, yes. And Georgia, yes. So even then, they were thinking and calculating that they didn't want to make, this equality of apportionment of representation, that the 3/5 rule was probably a little bit better. W. Cleon Skousen and some other men have actually dove into all of the details. I am not an expert on this, but I do know that slavery should have been eradicated. I think these men made a big error in determining what was best. Now, I'm being an armchair quarterback here. I believe in heaven there's probably some factors and things that we're not thinking about, we're not dealing with. It was Thomas Jefferson that even stated that they had the wolf by the ear. That was a metaphor he was creating, that holding on to slavery was tantamount to holding on to a wolf by the ear. He said, we can no more safely hold on to it nor let it go. It is too big of a dangerous problem that they didn't know how to resolve this. And had they, at that point in time, just ended it, it would have made all the difference. So, so Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, he basically states this, and he said he had several objections to the proposition of Mr. Williamson. One, it fettered the legislature too much. Two, it would exclude some states altogether who would not have a sufficient number to entitle them a single representative. Three, it would not consist of the resolution passed on Saturday last authorizing the legislature to adjust the representation from time to time on the principles of population or wealth or the principles of equity. Now, just I want you to understand what he just said. He basically was saying that they were the Congress was going to be able to manipulate the ratio of population and representation. That is not what ends up in the slave, or I should say not in the slave. That is not what ends up in the Constitution. The Constitution is fixed, and there is no mechanism of changing it, which is why Madison created that First Amendment of the Bill of Rights of the 12 amendments that were submitted. Anyway, he says this. This is Mr. Governor Morris again. If slaves were to be considered as inhabitants, not as wealth, then the said resolution would, because it's SD, he uses these abbreviations, so sometimes got to figure out what he's saying. Anyway, the said resolution would not be pursued if as wealth, then why is no other wealth but slaves included? These objections may perhaps be removed by the amendments, and he's making a salient point. Up in the North, they had factories. They had the ability of making things, and they had not factories that we see today, but the mercantile system and those types of tools and property of being able to build things and so forth. I mean, where were the ships being made? The ships were not being made in the South at that point in time, not nearly as much, because they were agrarian. And so, and who needed the ships? Who needed the fish for the fish trade? The Northern ships. Anyway, his great objection, the Governor Morris's great objection was that the number of inhabitants was not a proper standard of wealth. The amazing difference between the comparative numbers and the wealth of different countries, he's speaking of states, each state being a country, the wealth of different countries rendered all reasoning superfluous on the subject. Numbers might, with greater propriety, be deemed a measure of strength than of wealth. Yet the late defense made by Great Britain against her numerous enemies proved in the clearest manner that it is entirely fallacious, even in this respect. And so they kind of pursue on, and next thing you know, that same day, they start talking about land, and this gets into a little bit of oration by Mr. Madison. And so Mr. Madison stands up and says, he was not a little surprised to hear the implicit confidence urged by a member who on all occasions had inculcated so strongly the political depravity of men and the necessity of checking one vice and interest by opposing them to another vice and interest. If the representatives of the people would be bound by the ties that he mentioned, what need was there for a Senate, for the second branch of government? What of a revisionary power? But this, his reasoning was not inconsistent with his former reasoning, but with itself. At the same time that he recommended that this implicit confidence to the southern states in the northern majority, he was still more zealous in exhorting all to a jealousy of Western majority to reconcile with the gentleman. Now, so I don't know what he's speaking in shorthand, but he's probably referring to the growth of the Western states. Now, let's look at it this way, folks. When you look at the northeastern quadrant of, you know, from basically Maryland and Delaware going north, I believe the only state that actually had any Western land, and it was very limited, was the Ohio Valley to Pennsylvania. So as we, you know, looked forward, you know, as the growth of the Western lands and the availability, look at Virginia, the Carolinas, and so forth, they had strips of land that went all the way over the Pacific Ocean. And the small little states, Connecticut, New York, Vermont, and those states up in the northeastern quadrant were contained. They had no impact or no influence. Now, what I mean by this is it was Georgia, Virginia in the Articles of Confederation, and prior to that, the design was the nation of Virginia would be growing itself out. It would stay as one nation. Now we're talking about creating the states and who would be influencing those states. Well, it'd still be Virginia. It would still be the Carolinas. And so the northeastern states realized that there was a significant advantage, a strategic advantage of these southern states. And so they were doing everything they could to keep slavery in check and so forth, which is one of the reasons why the Northwest Ordinance was passed to stop slavery. Okay. So to reconcile the gentleman with himself, it must be imagined that he determined the human character by the points of the compass. The truth was that all men having power ought to be distrusted to a certain degree. The case of Pennsylvania had been mentioned, where it was admitted that those who were possessed of the power in the original settlement never admitted the new settlements to a due share of it. So what he just said right here is he basically said that the way Pennsylvania was being created and the way they were looking at the new states, they were not going to be given equal footing. That Pennsylvania would still maintain its control over those who were coming in and creating governments after them. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, we look at Pennsylvania as, you know, maybe there's this righteous. No. They were all, again, like Madison basically pointed out, he said that those, all men having power ought to be distrusted to a certain degree. That's the precursor to what he just said with Pennsylvania. Then he says, and this again is Madison, England was a still more striking example. The power there had long been in the hands of the boroughs of the minority, who had opposed and defeated every reform which had been attempted. Virginia was in a lesser degree another example. With regard to the Western states, he was clear and firm in the opinion that no favorable distinctions were admissible either in point of justice or policy. He thought also that the hope of the contributions to the treasury from them had been much underrated. Future contributions, it seemed to be understood, on all hands would be principally levied on imports and exports. The extent and the fertility of the western soil would for a long time give to agriculture a preference over manufactures. Trials would be repeated till some articles could be raised from it that would bear a transportation to places where they could be exchanged for imported manufactures. Whenever the Mississippi should be opened to them, which would of necessity be ye case, and I have no idea what ye means. Anyway, as soon as their population would subject them, I don't know if that's a year or what, Y-E period. Anyway, as soon as the population would subject them to any considerable share of the public burden, imposts on their trade could be collected with less expense and greater certainty than that on the Atlantic states. In the meantime, as the surplus must pass through the Atlantic states, their contribution would be levied in the same manner with those of the Atlantic states. He could not agree that any substantial objection lay against fixing the numbers for the perpetual standards of representation. It was said that the representation and taxation were to go with the taxation and ought to go together, that population and wealth were not measures of each. He basically admitted that in different climates, under different forms of government, and in different stages of civilization, the inference was perfectly just. He would admit in no situation numbers of inhabitants were an accurate measure of wealth. He contended, however, that in the United States, capital U, it was sufficiently so for the object in contemplation, although their climate varied considerably. As yet the governments, the laws, and the manners of all were nearly the same, and the intercourse, or the, you know, the conversations between different parts, perfectly free, population, industry, arts, and the value of labor would certainly tend to equalize themselves. The value of labor might be considered as the principal criterion of wealth and ability to support taxes, and this would find its level in different places where the intercourse should be easy and free with as much certainty as the value of money or anything or any other thing. Whenever labor would yield most, people would resort till the competition should destroy the inequality. Hence, it is the people that are the constantly swarming from the more to the less populous place, from Europe to America, from northern to middle, and parts of the United States to the southern and western. They go where land is cheaper because their labor is dearer. If it be true that the same quantity of produce raised on the banks of Ohio is of less value than on the Delaware, it is also true that the same labor will raise twice or thrice the quantity in the former, and that in and that it will rise in the latter. So he's basically giving them kind of this economic, big picture economic look, that the one thing will prevail, that by expanding, it will actually create and maintain this natural equilibrium. He doesn't conclude on that, but when you think about it, when all of a sudden labor becomes more and more scarce, you would think that supply and demand would actually shift. You know, okay, so we're buying apples in Massachusetts, and labor, there's people in Massachusetts start moving west because they can do it for, you know, cheaper, they can grow more and what have you. And so they can act because the greater quantity of goods they can produce, and their labor would be a little bit cheaper, but they would make more money. And so what ends up happening is they would be shutting down, or they wouldn't be tending to the orchards of Massachusetts because the apples of Massachusetts would be too expensive. So what do? Well, they end up shifting their labor. And those who, you know, maintain the orchards, or they change the orchards to manufacturing, and then they change the manufacturing to the South. How do you think the Rust Belt was created? Because the cost of labor, the cost of getting the good, the raw material and everything else. I tell people all the time, when you look at the cost of anything, the greatest single cost in building your home, in doing any endeavor, if labor is involved, the greatest cost is labor. I mean, there may be some exceptions to this, but that is the rule. Colonel Mason agreed with Governor Morris that we ought to leave the interest of the people to the representatives of the people. But the objection was that the legislature would cease to be the representatives of the people. It would continue so no longer than the states now containing a majority of the people should retain the majority of the people. As soon as the southern and western populations would predominate, which must happen in a few years, the power would be in the hands of the minority and would never be yielded to the majority unless provided by the Constitution. So in other words, Mason's making this salient point. He's saying, hey, look, you know, if we don't create this protection of maintaining this equality of representation and this equality in both houses and so forth, because right now everything was apportioned. In other words, the Senate was going to grow. The Senate wasn't necessarily fixed. And so they hadn't even nailed everything down yet. And so they were kind of, Mason was just making this huge point. This was big. He was saying that if we don't protect the Western states when they start off, why would you think that they would worry about protecting us when they have greater numbers and greater capabilities and resources than us? Now, here's the interesting thing, because not many of these men understood. And it's probably because empirical data really didn't exist of mass populations. In the past two centuries, mass populations have proven, and historically have proven, that the majority of the people, like 75% of the population, lives within 250 miles from the coastline of the ocean, the predominant ocean. So in other words, when you look at North America, and you take that 250-mile swath and you go down from Maine down to Florida and over to down across the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, and boom, you go across the Mexican line and you go up California to Washington and you go across, you're going to realize that the majority of the people that live on those coastlines literally are the majority of the Americans. It's probably greater than 75%. Why is that? Because international commerce and trade and everything else is really where there is more opportunity. So what ended up happening wasn't that the Western states were going to... So in Mason's point here, And it was, I think, a reality for their paradigm and their world. And what I mean by that is there was advantages to moving west and actually accessing the Mississippi, accessing the Missouri, and so forth. And so this migration, there was great opportunity because they could still do trade from these rivers. But many, when we really think about it, many today still have migrated and live within these lanes of international commerce for shipping. Don't tell me how important international shipping is, because that's why there are, you know, a couple of monopolies that are in competition with each other, because there's that much money involved in shipping. Now, Mason goes on and says, on the question for postponing Mr. Williamson's motion in order to consider that of Mr. Rutledge, it passed in the negative. So in other words, they weren't going to postpone it. And so on the question of the first clause of Mr. Williamson's motion, we didn't read these motions, so I'll just kind of go on. Let me just move on to what Mr. King basically then states. Mr. King, being much opposed to fixing numbers as the rule of representation, was particularly so on account of the blacks. He thought the admission of them with whites at all would excite great discontents among the states having no slaves. Now, Mr. King, Rufus King, Massachusetts, he's absolutely right. He had never said as to any particular point that he would in no event acquiesce in and support it, but he would say that if any case such a declaration was to be made by him, it would be in this. He remarked that in the temporary allotment of representatives made by the committee, the southern states had received more than the number of their whites and three-fifths of their black inhabitants and their three-fifths their black inhabitants entitled to them. So in other words, he was already saying they were getting more than what they should have. Mr. Sherman basically said South Carolina had more beyond her proportion than New York and New Hampshire, nor either of them more than was necessary in order to avoid fractions or reducing them below their proportion. Georgia had more, but the rapid growth of that state seemed to justify it. In general, the allotment might not be as just, but considering all circumstances, he was satisfied with it. Mr. Gorham of Massachusetts, now, you know, he pretty much aroused because we've actually heard the Southerners refer to many of his postulations, motions, and so forth. Mr. Gorham supported the propriety of establishing numbers. Actually, I'm not even going to read this, so I'm going to kind of highlight this as where we'll pick this up next week because I've got less than a half a minute. As we're going through this, we're actually seeing how the Constitution was being framed and what were the premises behind it. When we get into the ratification debates, it is those premises that actually permeate into those debates so that everybody understands what each of the clauses mean and why what we're reading, how this evolution occurred, is significant. Because it's not like they all agreed, but enough agreed to make these things permanent in the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort.
We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.